Moss made his way down the ward and back again, holding on to the nurse's arm. She said encouraging things to him in Spanish. They turned at the end of the bay and started back. The sweat stood on his forehead.
Andale, she said. Que bueno.
He nodded. Damn right, bueno, he said. Late in the night, he woke from a troubling dream and struggled down the hallway and asked to use the telephone. He dialed the number in Odessa and leaned heavily on the counter and listened to it ring. It rang a long time. Finally, her mother answered. It's Llewellyn.
She don't want to talk to you.
Yes, she does.
Do you know what time it is?
I don't care what time it is. Don't you hang up this phone.
I told her what was going to happen, didn't I? Chapter and verse, I said, this is what will come to pass. And now it has come to pass.
Don't you hang up this phone. You get her and you put her on. When she picked up the phone, she said,
I didn't think you'd do me this away.
Hello, darling. How are you? Are you all right, Llewellyn? What happened to them words?
Where are you?
Piedras Negras.
What am I supposed to do, Llewellyn?
Are you all right?
No, I'm not all right. How would I be all right? People calling here about you? I had the sheriff up here from Terrell County, showed up at the damn door. I thought you was dead.
I ain't dead. What did you tell him?
What could I tell him?
He might con you into saying something.
You're hurt, ain't you?
What makes you say that?
I can hear it in your voice. Are you okay?
I'm okay.
Where are you?
I told you where I was.
You sound like you're in a bus station.
Carla Jean, I think you need to get out of there.
Out of where?
Out of that house.
You're scaring me, Llewellyn. Out of here to go where?
It don't matter. I just don't think you should stay there. You could go to a motel.
And do what with Mama?
She'll be all right.
She'll be all right?
Yes.
You don't know that.
Llewellyn didn't answer.
Do you?
I just don't think anybody will bother her.
You don't think?
You need to get out. Just take her with you.
I can't take my mama to a motel. She's sick if you ain't forgot.
What did the sheriff say?
Said he was looking for you. What do you think he said?
What else did he say? She didn't answer. Carla Jean? She sounded like she was crying. What else did he say, Carla Jean?
He said you was fixin' to get yourself killed.
Well, that's what he would say. She was quiet a long time. Carla Jean.
Llewellyn, I don't even want the money. I just want us to be back like we was.
We will be.
No, we won't. I've thought about it. It's a false god.
Yeah, but it's real money. She said his name again, and then she did begin to cry. He tried to talk to her, but she didn't answer. He stood listening to her sobbing quietly in Odessa. What do you want me to do? He said. She didn't answer. Carla Jean?
I want things to be like they was.
If I tell you I'll try and fix everything, will you do what I ask you?
Yes, I will.
I've got a number here I can call, somebody that can help us.
Can you trust them?
I don't know. I just know I can't trust nobody else. I'll call you tomorrow. I didn't think they'd find you up there, or I never would have sent you. I'll call you tomorrow. He hung up the phone and dialed the mobile number that Wells had given him. It answered on the second ring, but it wasn't Wells. I think I got the wrong number, he said.
You don't have the wrong number. You need to come see me.
Who is this?
You know who it is.
Moss leaned on the counter, his forehead against his fist. Where's Wells?
He can't help you now. What kind of deal did you cut with him?
I didn't cut any kind of deal.
Yes, you did. How much was he going to give you?
I don't know what you're talking about.
Where's the money?
What did you do with Wells?
We had a difference of opinion. You don't need to concern yourself about Wells. He's out of the picture. You need to talk to me.
I don't need to talk to you.
I think you do. Do you know where I'm going?
Why would I care where you're going?
Do you know where I'm going?
Moss didn't answer.
Are you there?
I'm here.
I know where you are.
Yeah? Where am I?
You're in a hospital in Piedras Negras. But that's not where I'm going. Do you know where I'm going?
Yeah. I know where you're going.
You can turn all this around.
Why would I believe you?
You believed Wells.
I didn't believe Wells.
You called him.
So? I called him.
Tell me, what do you want me to do?
Moss shifted his weight. Sweat stood on his forehead. He didn't answer.
Tell me something. I'm waiting.
I could be waiting for you when you get there, you know, Moss said. Charter a plane? You thought about that?
That would be okay, but you won't.
How do you know I won't?
You wouldn't have told me. Anyway, I have to go.
You know they won't be there.
It doesn't make any difference where they are.
So what are you going up there for?
You know how this is going to turn out, don't you?
No.
Do you?
Yes, I do.
I think you do, too. You just haven't accepted it yet. So this is what I'll do. You bring me the money, and I'll let her walk. Otherwise, she's accountable. The same as you. I don't know if you care about that, but that's the best deal you're going to get. I won't tell you you can save yourself, because you can't.
Well, I'm gonna bring you something, all right, Moss said. I've decided to make you a special project of mine. You ain't gonna have to look for me at all.
I'm glad to hear that. You were beginning to disappoint me.
You won't be disappointed.
Good.
You don't have to, by God, worry about being disappointed.
He left before daylight, dressed in the muslin hospital gown with the overcoat over it. The skirt of the overcoat was stiff with blood. He had no shoes. In the inside pocket of the coat was the money he'd folded away there, stiff and blood-stained. He stood in the street looking toward the lights. He'd no notion where he was. The concrete cold under his feet. He made his way down to the corner. A few cars passed. He walked down to the lights at the next corner and stopped and leaned with one hand against the building. He had two white lozenges in his overcoat pocket that he'd saved, and he took one now, swallowing it dry. He thought he was going to vomit. He stood there for a long time. There was a windowsill there he'd have sat on, save that it was spiked with pointed iron bars to discourage loiterers. A cab went by, and he raised one hand, but it kept going. He was going to have to go out into the street. And after a while, he did. He'd been tottering there for some time when another cab passed, and he raised his hand, and it pulled to the curb. The driver studied him. Moss leaned on the window.
"Can you take me across the bridge?" he said.
"To the other side?"
"Yes, to the other side."
"You got monies?"
"Yes, I got monies."
The driver looked dubious.
$20, he said.
"Okay."
At the gate, the guard leaned down and regarded him where he sat in the dim rear of the cab.
"What country were you born in?" he said.
"The United States."
"What are you bringing in?"
"Not anything."
The guard studied him.
"Would you mind stepping out here?" he said.
Moss pushed down on the door handle and leaned on the front seat to ease himself out of the cab. He stood.
"What happened to your shoes?"
"I don't know."
"You don't have any clothes on, do you?"
"I got clothes on." The second guard was waving the cars past. He pointed for the cab driver.
"Would you please pull your cab over into the second space there?"
The driver put the cab in gear.
"Would you mind stepping away from the vehicle?"
Moss stepped away. The cab pulled into the parking area, and the driver cut the engine. Moss looked at the guard. The guard seemed to be waiting for him to say something, but he didn't.
They took him inside and sat him in a steel chair in a small white office. Another man came in and stood leaning against a steel desk. He looked him over.
"How much have you had to drink?"
"I ain't had anything to drink. What happened to you?"
"What do you mean?"
"What happened to your clothes?"
"I don't know. Do you have any identification?"
"No."
"Nothing?"
"No."
The man leaned back, his arms crossed at his chest. He said,
"Who do you think gets to go through this gate into the United States of America?"
"I don't know. American citizens. Some American citizens."
"Who do you think decides that?"
"You do, I reckon."
"That's correct."
"And how do I decide?"
"I don't know. I ask questions. If I get sensible answers, then they get to go to America. If I don't get sensible answers, they don't."
"Is there anything about that that you don't understand?"
"No, sir."
"Then maybe you'd like to start over."
"All right."
"We need to hear more about why you're out here with no clothes on."
"I got a overcoat on. Are you jacking with me?"
"No, sir."
"Don't jack with me."
"Are you in the service?"
"No, sir. I'm a veteran."
"What branch of the service?"
"United States Army."
"Were you in NAM?"
"Yes, sir. 3 tours."
"What outfit?"
12th Infantry Battalion."
"What were your dates of tour duty?"
"August 7th, 1966 to May 2nd, 1968.
The man watched him for some time. Moss looked at him and looked away. He looked toward the door, the empty hall, sitting hunched forward in the overcoat with his elbows on his knees.
"Are you all right?"
"Yes, sir, I'm all right.
I got a wife that'll come and get me if you all will let me go on."
"Have you got any money?"
"You got change for a phone call?"
"Yes, sir."
He heard claws scrabbling on the tiles. A guard was standing there with a German shepherd on a lead. The man jutted his chin at the guard.
"Get someone to help this man. He needs to get into town. Is the taxi gone?"
"Yes, sir. It was clean. I know."
"Get someone to help him."
He looked at Moss.
"Where are you from?"
"I'm from San Saba, Texas."
"Does your wife know where you are?"
"Yes, sir. I talked to her here just a while ago."
"Did you all have a fight?"
"Did who have a fight?"
"You and your wife."
"Well, somewhat of a one, I reckon, yes, sir."
"You need to tell her you're sorry."
"Sir?"
"I said you need to tell her you're sorry."
"Yes, sir, I will."
"Even if you think it was her fault?"
"Yes, sir."
"Go on, get your ass out of here."
"Yes, sir."
"Sometimes you have a little problem and you don't fix it, and then all of a sudden it ain't a little problem anymore. You understand what I'm telling you?"
"Yes, sir, I do."
"Go on."
"Yes, sir."
It was almost daylight and the cab was long gone. He set out up the street. A bloody serum was leaking from his wound and it was running down the inside of his leg. People paid him little mind. He turned up Adams Street and stopped at a clothing store and peered in. Lights were on at the rear. He knocked at the door and waited and knocked again. Finally, a small man in a white shirt and a black tie opened the door and looked out at him.
"I know you ain't open," Moss said, "but I need some clothes real bad."
The man nodded and swung open the door.
"Come in,"
he said. They walked side by side down the aisle toward the boot section. Tony Lama, Justin, Nakona. There were some low chairs there, and Moss eased himself down and sat with his hands gripping the chair arms.
I need boots and some clothes, he said. I got some medical problems, and I don't want to walk around no more than what I can help. The man nodded. Yes, sir, he said. Of course. Do you carry the Larry Mahans? No, sir, we don't. That's all right. I need a pair of Wrangler jeans, 32 by 34 length, a shirt size large, some socks, and show me some Nakona boots in a 10.5, and I need a belt.
Yes, sir. Did you want to look at hats?
Moss looked across the store.
I think a hat would be good. You got any of them stockman's hats with a small brim, 7 3/8?
Yes, we do. We have a 3X Beaver in the Resistol and a little better grade in the Stetson, a 5X, I think it is.
Let me see the Stetson, that silver belly color.
All right, sir. Are white socks all right?
White socks is all I wear.
What about underwear?
Maybe a pair of jockey shorts, 32 or medium.
Yes, sir. You just make yourself comfortable. Are you all right?
I'm all right. The man nodded and turned to go. Can I ask you something? Moss said.
Yes, sir.
Do you get a lot of people come in here with no clothes on?
No, sir, I wouldn't say a lot.
He carried the pile of new clothing with him to the dressing room and slid off the coat and hung it from the hook on the back of the door. A pale, dried blood was crusted across his sallow, sunken paunch. He pushed at the edges of the tape, but they wouldn't stick. He eased himself down on the wooden bench and pulled on the socks, and he opened the package of shorts and took them out and pulled them over his feet and up to his knees, and then stood and pulled them carefully up over the dressing. He sat again and undid the shirt from its cardboard forms and endless pins. When he came out of the dressing room, he had the coat over his arm. He walked up and down the creaking wooden aisle. The clerk stood looking down at the boots.
"The lizard takes longer to break in," he said.
"Yeah, hot in the summer, too. These are all right. Let's try that hat. I ain't been duded up like this since I got out of the Army."
The sheriff sipped his coffee and set the cup back down in the same ring on the glass desk top that he'd taken it from.
"They're fixing to close the hotel," he said.
Bell nodded.
I ain't surprised. They all quit? That feller hadn't pulled but two shifts. I blame myself. Never occurred to me that son of a bitch would come back. I just never even imagined such a thing. He might never have left. I thought about that, too. The reason nobody knows what he looks like is that they don't none of them live long enough to tell it. This is a goddamn homicidal lunatic, Ed Tom. Yeah, I don't think he's a lunatic, though. Well, what would you call him? I don't know. When are they fixing to close it? It's done closed as far as that goes. You got a key? Yeah, I got a key. It's a crime scene. Why don't we go over there and look around some more? All right, we can do that.
The first thing they saw was the transponder unit sitting on a windowsill in the hallway. Bell picked it up and turned it in his hand, looking at the dial and the knobs.
That ain't a goddamn bomb, is it, Sheriff? No. That's all we need. It's a tracking device. So whatever it was they was tracking, they found. Probably. How long has it been sitting there, do you reckon? I don't know. I think I might be able to guess what they were tracking, though. Maybe, Bell said. There's something about this whole deal that don't rattle right. It ain't supposed to. We got an ex-army colonel here with most of his head gone that you had to ID off of his fingerprints, what fingers wasn't shot off. Regular army, 24 years service. Not a piece of paper on him. He'd been robbed. Yeah. What do you know about this that you ain't telling, Sheriff? You got the same facts I got. I ain't talking about facts. You think this whole mess has moved south? Bell shook his head. I don't know. You got a dog in this hunt? Not really. A couple of kids from my county that might be sort of involved that ought not to be. Sort of involved? Yeah. Are we talking kin? No. Just people from my county. People I'm supposed to be looking after.
He handed the transponder unit to the sheriff.
What am I supposed to do with this? It's Maverick County property, crime scene evidence.
The sheriff shook his head. Dope, he said.
Dope. They sell that shit to school kids. It's worse than that.
How's that?
School kids buy it.
Part 7.
I won't talk about the war, neither. I was supposed to be a war hero, and I lost a whole squad of men, got decorated for it. They died, and I got a medal. I don't even need to know what you think about that. There ain't a day I don't remember it. Some boys I know come back. They went on to school up at Austin on the GI Bill. They had hard things to say about their people. Some of them did. Called them a bunch of rednecks and all such as that. Didn't like their politics. 2 generations in this county is a long time. You're talking about the early settlers. I used to tell them that having your wife and children killed and scalped and gutted like fish has a tendency to make some people irritable, but they didn't seem to know what I was talking about. I think the 60s in this country sobered some of them up. I hope it did. I read in the papers here a while back some teachers come across a survey that was sent out back in the 30s to a number of schools around the country. Had this questionnaire about what was the problems with teaching in the schools, and they come across these forms. They'd been filled out and sent in from around the country answering these questions, and the biggest problems they could name was things like talking in class and running in the hallways, chewing gum, copying homework, things of that nature. So they got one of them forms that was blank and printed up a bunch of them and sent them back out to the same schools 40 years later. Well, here come the answers back. Rape, arson, murder, drugs, suicide. So I think about that. Because a lot of the time, ever when I say anything about how the world is going to hell in a handbasket, people will just sort of smile and tell me I'm getting old. That it's one of the symptoms. But my feeling about that is that anybody that can't tell the difference between raping and murdering people and chewing gum has got a whole lot bigger of a problem than what I've got. And 40 years is not a long time, neither. Maybe the next 40 of it will bring some of them out from under the ether, if it ain't too late. Here, a year or two back, me and Loretta went to a conference in Corpus Christi, and I got set next to this woman. She was the wife of somebody or other, and she kept talking about the right wing this and the right wing that. I ain't even sure what she meant by it. The people I know are mostly just common people. Common as dirt, as the saying goes. I told her that, and she looked at me funny. She thought I was saying something bad about them, but of course that's a high compliment in my part of the world. She kept on. Finally told me, said, I don't like the way this country is headed. I want my granddaughter to be able to have an abortion. And I said, well, ma'am, I don't think you got any worries about the way the country is headed. The way I see it going, I don't have much doubt that what she'll be able to have an abortion. I'm going to say that not only will she be able to have an abortion, she'll be able to have you put to sleep. Which pretty much ended the conversation.
Chigurh limped up the 17 flights of concrete steps in the cool concrete well.
And when he got to the steel door on the landing, he shot the cylinder out of the lock with the plunger of the stun gun and opened the door and stepped into the hallway and shut the door behind him. He stood leaning against the door with the shotgun in both hands, listening, breathing no harder than if he'd just got up out of a chair. He went back down the hallway and picked the crushed cylinder out of the floor and put it in his pocket and went on to the elevator and stood listening again. He took off his boots and stood them by the elevator door and went down the hallway in his sock feet, walking slowly, favoring his wounded leg.
The doors to the office were open onto the hallway. He stopped. He thought that perhaps the man didn't see his own shadow on the outer hallway wall, ill-defined, but there. Chigurh thought it an odd oversight, but he knew that fear of an enemy can often blind men to other hazards, not least the shape which they themselves make in the world. He slipped the strap from his shoulder and lowered the air tank to the floor. He studied the stance of the man's shadow, framed there by the light from the smoked glass window behind him. He pushed the shotgun's follower slightly back with the heel of his hand to check the chambered round, and pushed the safety off. The man was holding a small pistol at the level of his belt. Chigurh stepped into the doorway and shot him in the throat with a load of number 10 shot, the size collectors use to take bird specimens. The man fell back through his swivel chair, knocking it over, and went to the floor and lay there, twitching and gurgling. Chigurh picked up the smoking shotgun shell from the carpet and put it in his pocket and walked into the room with the pale smoke still drifting from the canister fitted to the end of the sawed-off barrel. He walked around behind the desk and stood looking down at the man. The man was lying on his back, and he had one hand over his throat, but the blood was pumping steadily through his fingers and out onto the rug. His face was full of small holes, but his right eye seemed intact, and he looked up at Chigurh and tried to speak from out of his bubbling mouth. Chigurh dropped to one knee and leaned on the shotgun and looked at him.
"What is it?"
he said.
"What are you trying to tell me?"
The man moved his head. The blood gurgled in his throat.
"Can you hear me?"
Chigurh said. He didn't answer.
"I'm the man you sent Carson Wells to kill. Is that what you wanted to know?"
He watched him. He was wearing a blue nylon running suit and a pair of white leather shoes. Blood was starting to pool about his head, and he was shivering as if he were cold.
"The reason I used the bird shot was that I didn't want to break the glass behind you, to rain glass on people in the street."
He nodded toward the window where the man's upper silhouette stood outlined in the small gray pockmarks the lead had left in the glass. He looked at the man. The man's hand had gone slack at his throat, and the blood had slowed. He looked at the pistol lying there. He rose and pushed the safety back on the shotgun and stepped past the man to the window and inspected the pockings the lead had made. When he looked down at the man again, the man was dead. He crossed the room and stood at the doorway, listening. He went out and down the hall and collected his tank and the stun gun and got his boots and stepped into them and pulled them up. Then he walked down the corridor and went out through the metal door and down the concrete steps to the garage, where he'd left his vehicle. When they got to the bus station, it was just breaking daylight, gray and cold and a light rain falling. She leaned forward over the seat and paid the driver and gave him a $2 tip. He got out and went around to the trunk and opened it and got their bags and set them in the portico and brought the walker around to her mother's side and opened the door. Her mother turned and began to struggle out into the rain.
"Mama, will you wait? I need to get around there." "I knowed this is what it would come to,"
the mother said.
"I said it 3 years ago." "It ain't been 3 years. I used them very words. Just wait till I get around there." "In the rain,"
her mother said. She looked up at the cab driver.
"I got cancer," she said. "Now look at this. Not even a home to go to."
"Yes, ma'am."
"We're going to El Paso, Texas. You know how many people I know in El Paso, Texas?"
"No, ma'am." She paused with her arm on the door and held up her hand and made an O with her thumb and forefinger.
"That's how many," she said.
"Yes, ma'am." They sat in the coffee shop, surrounded by their bags and parcels, and stared out at the rain and at the idling buses, at the gray day breaking. She looked at her mother.
"Did you want some more coffee?"
she said. The old woman didn't answer.
"You ain't speaking, I reckon. I don't know what there is to speak about.
Well, I don't guess I do either.
Whatever y'all done, you done. I don't know why I ought to have to run from the law.
We ain't running from the law, Mama.
You couldn't call on them to help you, though, could you?
Call on who?
The law.
No, we couldn't.
That's what I thought.
The old woman adjusted her teeth with her thumb and stared out the window. After a while, the bus came. The driver stowed her walker in the luggage bay under the bus, and they helped her up the steps and put her in the first seat.
I got cancer, she told the driver.
Carla Jean put their bags in the bin overhead and sat down. The old woman didn't look at her.
3 years ago, she said. You didn't have to have no dream about it, no revelation nor nothing. I don't give myself no credit. Anybody could have told you the same thing.
Well, I wasn't asking.
The old woman shook her head, looking out through the window and down at the table they'd vacated.
I give myself no credit, she said. I'd be the last in the world to do that.
Shiger pulled up across the street and shut off the engine. He turned off the lights and sat watching the darkened house. The green diode numerals on the radio put the time at 1:17. He sat there till 1:22, and then he took the flashlight from the glove box and got out and closed the truck door and crossed the street to the house. He opened the screen door and punched out the cylinder and walked in and shut the door behind him and stood listening. There was a light coming from the kitchen, and he walked down the hallway with the flashlight in one hand and the shotgun in the other. When he got to the doorway, he stopped and listened again. The light came from a bare bulb on the back porch. He went on into the kitchen. A bare formica and chrome table in the center of the room with a box of cereal standing on it. The shadow of the kitchen window lying on the linoleum floor. He crossed the room and opened the refrigerator and looked in. He put the shotgun in the crook of his arm and took out a can of orange soda and opened it with his forefinger and stood drinking it, listening for anything that might follow the metallic click of the can. He drank and set the half-empty can on the counter and shut the refrigerator door and walked through the dining room and into the living room and sat in an easy chair in the corner and looked out at the street. After a while, he rose and crossed the room and went up the stairs. He stood listening at the head of the stairwell. When he entered the old woman's room, he could smell the sweet, musty odor of sickness, and he thought for a moment she might even be lying there in the bed. He switched on the flashlight and went into the bathroom. He stood reading the labels of the pharmacy bottles on the vanity. He looked out the window at the street below, the dull winter light from the street lamps. 2 in the morning, dry, cold, silent. He went out and down the hallway to the small bedroom at the rear of the house. He emptied her bureau drawers out onto the bed and sat sorting through her things, holding up from time to time some item and studying it in the bluish light from the yard lamp. A plastic hairbrush, a cheap fairground bracelet. Weighing these things in his hand like a medium who might thereby divine some fact concerning the owner. He sat turning the pages in a photo album. School friends, family, a dog, a house, not this one, a man who may have been her father. He put 2 pictures of her in his shirt pocket. There was a ceiling fan overhead. He got up and pulled the chain and lay down on the bed with a shotgun alongside him, watching the wooden blades wheel slowly in the light from the window. After a while, he got up and took the chair from the desk in the corner and tilted it and pushed the top back ladder up under the doorknob. Then he sat on the bed and pulled off his boots and stretched out and went to sleep. In the morning, he walked through the house again upstairs and down and then returned to the bathroom at the end of the hall to shower. He left the curtain pulled back, the water spraying onto the floor. The hallway door open and the shotgun lying on the vanity 1 foot away. He dried the dressing on his leg with a hair dryer and shaved and dressed and went down to the kitchen and ate a bowl of cereal and milk, walking through the house as he ate. In the living room, he stopped and looked at the mail lying in the floor beneath the brass slot in the front door. He stood there, chewing slowly. Then he set the bowl and spoon on the coffee table and crossed the room and bent over and picked up the mail and stood sorting through it. He sat in a chair by the door and opened the phone bill and cupped the envelope and blew into it. He glanced down the list of calls. Halfway down was the Terrell County Sheriff's Department. He folded the bill and put it back in the envelope and put the envelope in his shirt pocket. Then he looked through the other pieces of mail again. He rose and went into the kitchen and got the shotgun off the table and came back and stood where he'd stood before. He crossed to a cheap mahogany desk and opened the top drawer. The drawer was stuffed with mail. He laid the shotgun down and sat in the chair and pulled the mail out and piled it on the desk and began to go through it. Moss spent the day in a cheap motel on the edge of town, sleeping naked in the bed with his new clothes on wire hangers in the closet. When he woke, the shadows were long in the motel courtyard, and he struggled up and sat on the edge of the bed, a pale blood stain the size of his hand on the sheets. There was a paper bag on the night table that held things he'd bought from a drugstore in town, and he picked it up and limped into the bathroom. He showered and shaved and brushed his teeth for the first time in 5 days, and then sat on the edge of the tub and taped fresh gauze over his wounds. Then he got dressed and called a cab. He was standing in front of the motel office when the cab pulled up. He climbed into the rear seat, got his breath, then reached and shut the door. He regarded the face of the driver in the rearview mirror. "Do you want to make some money?" he said. "Yeah, I want to make some money." Moss took 5 of the hundreds and tore them in 2 and passed 1/2 across the back of the seat to the driver. The driver counted the torn bills and put them in his shirt pocket and looked at Moss in the mirror and waited. "What's your name?"
"Paul,"
said the driver.
"You got the right attitude, Paul. I won't get you in trouble. I just don't want you to leave me somewheres that I don't want to be left."
"All right."
"Have you got a flashlight?"
"Yeah, I got a flashlight."
"Let me have it."
The driver passed the flashlight to the back.
"You're the man," Moss said.
"Where are we going?"
"Down the river road."
"I ain't picking nobody up."
"We're not picking anybody up."
The driver watched him in the mirror.
"No drogas," he said.
"No drogas."
The driver waited.
"I'm going to pick up a briefcase. It belongs to me. You can look inside if you want. Nothing illegal."
"I can look inside."
"Yes, you can."
"I hope you're not jerking me around."
"No."
"I like money, but I like staying out of jail even better."
"I'm the same way myself," Moss said.
They drove slowly up the road toward the bridge. Moss leaned forward over the seat.
"I want you to park under the bridge," he said.
"All right."
"I'm going to unscrew the bulb out of this dome light."
"They watch this road round the clock,"
the driver said.
"I know that."
The driver pulled off the road and shut off the engine and the lights and looked at Moss in the mirror. Moss took the bulb from the light and laid it in the plastic lens and handed it across the seat to the driver and opened the door.
"I should be back in just a few minutes," he said.
The cane was dusty, the stalks close-grown. He pushed his way through carefully, holding the light at his knees with his hand partly across the lens. The case was sitting in the brake, right side up and intact as if someone had simply set it there. He switched off the light and picked it up and made his way back in the dark, taking his sight by the span of the bridge overhead. When he got to the cab, he opened the door and set the case in the seat and got in carefully and shut the door. He handed the flashlight to the driver and leaned back in the seat.
"Let's go," he said.
"What's in there?" the driver said.
"Money."
"Money?"
"Money."
The driver started the engine and pulled out onto the road.
"Turn your lights on," Moss said. He turned the lights on.
"How much money?"
"A lot of money." What will you take to drive me to San Antonio?
The driver thought about it.
You mean on top of the 500?
Yes.
How about a grand all in?
Everything.
Yes.
You got it.
The driver nodded.
Then how about the other half of these five Caesars I already got?
Moss took the bills from his pocket and handed them across the back of the seat.
What if the Migra stop us?
They won't stop us, Moss said.
How do you know? There's too much shit still down the road that I got to deal with. It ain't going to end here.
I hope you're right.
Trust me, Moss said. Yeah, I hate hearing them words, the driver said. I always did.
Have you ever said them?
Yeah, I've said them. That's how come I know what they're worth.
He spent the night in a roadway inn on Highway 90, just west of town, and in the morning he went down and got a paper and climbed laboriously back to his room. He couldn't buy a gun from a dealer because he had no identification, but he could buy one out of the paper, and he did. A Tech 9, with two extra magazines and a box and a half of shells. The man delivered the gun to his door, and he paid him in cash. He turned the piece in his hand. It had a greenish, parkerized finish, semi-automatic.
When was the last time you fired it? He said.
I ain't never fired it.
Are you sure it fires?
Why would it not?
I don't know.
Well, I don't either.
After he left, Moss walked out onto the prairie behind the motel with one of the motel pillows under his arm, and he wrapped the pillow about the muzzle of the gun and fired off three rounds, and then stood there in the cold sunlight, watching the feathers drift across the gray chaparral, thinking about his life, what was past, and what was to come. Then he turned and walked slowly back to the motel, leaving the burnt pillow on the ground. He rested in the lobby and then climbed up to the room again. He bathed in the tub and looked at the exit hole in his lower back in the bathroom mirror. It looked pretty ugly. There were drains in both holes that he wanted to pull out, but he didn't. He pulled loose the plaster on his arm and looked at the deep furrow the bullet had cut there, and then taped the dressing back again. He dressed and put some more of the bills into the back pocket of his jeans, and he fitted the pistol and the magazines and the shells into the case and closed it and called a cab and picked up the document case and went out and down the stairs. He bought a 1978 Ford pickup with four-wheel drive and a 460 engine from a lot on North Broadway and paid the man in cash and got the title notarized in the office and put the title in the glove box and drove away. He drove back to the motel and checked out and left, the Tech 9 under the seat and the document case and his bag of clothes sitting in the floor on the passenger side of the truck. At the on-ramp at Burney, there was a girl hitchhiking, and Moss pulled over and blew the horn and watched her in the rearview mirror, running, her blue nylon knapsack slung over one shoulder. She climbed in the truck and looked at him. 15, 16, red hair.
How far are you going?
She said.
Can you drive?
Yeah, I can drive. It ain't no stick shift, is it?
No. Get out and come around.
She left her knapsack on the seat and got out of the truck and crossed in front of it. Moss pushed the knapsack into the floor and eased himself across, and she got in and put the truck in drive, and they pulled out onto the interstate.
How old are you?
18.
Bullshit. What are you doing out here? Don't you know it's dangerous to hitchhike?
Yeah, I know it.
He took off his hat and put it on the seat beside him and leaned back and closed his eyes.
Don't go over the speed limit, he said. You get us stopped by the cops and you and me both will be in a shit pot full of trouble.
All right.
I'm serious. You go over the speed limit and I'll set your ass out by the side of the road.
All right.
He tried to sleep, but he couldn't. He was in a lot of pain. After a while, he sat up and got his hat off the seat and put it on and looked over at the speedometer.
Can I ask you something?
She said.
You can ask.
Are you running from the law?
Moss eased himself in the seat and looked at her, and looked out at the highway. "What makes you ask that?"
"On account of what you said back yonder about being stopped by the police."
"What if I was?"
"Then I think I ought to just get out up here."
"You don't think that. You just want to know where you stand." She looked at him out of the corner of her eye. Moss studied the passing country. "If you spent 3 days with me," he said, "I could have you holding up gas stations. Be no trick at all." She gave him a funny little half smile.
"Is that what you do?" she said. "Hold up gas stations?"
"No, I don't have to. Are you hungry?"
"I'm all right."
"When'd you last eat?"
"I don't like for people to start asking me when I eat last."
"All right. When did you eat last?"
"I knowed you was a smartass from the time I got in the truck."
"Yeah? Pull off up here at this next exit. Supposed to be 4 miles. And reach me that machine gun from under the seat." Bell drove slowly across the cattle guard and got out and closed the gate and got back in the truck and drove across the pasture and parked at the well and got out and walked over to the tank. He put his hand in the water and raised a palm full and let it spill again. He took off his hat and passed his wet hand through his hair and looked up at the windmill. He looked out at the slow, dark elliptic of the blades turning in the dry and wind-bent grass. A low wooden trundling under his feet. Then he just stood there, paying the brim of his hat slowly through his fingers. The posture of a man, perhaps, who has just buried something.
"I don't know a damn thing," he said.
When he got home, she had supper waiting. He dropped the keys to the pickup in the kitchen drawer and went to the sink to wash his hands. His wife laid a piece of paper on the counter, and he stood looking at it.
"Did she say where she was? This is a West Texas number."
"She just said it was Carla Jean and give the number."
He went to the sideboard and called. She and her grandmother were in a motel outside of El Paso.
"I need for you to tell me something," she said.
"All right."
"Is your word good?"
"Yes, it is."
"Even to me?"
"I'd say especially to you."
He could hear her breathing in the receiver, traffic in the distance.
"Sheriff?"
"Yes, ma'am."
"If I tell you where he called from, do you give your word that no harm will come to him?"
"I can give my word that no harm will come to him from me. I can do that."
After a while, she said,
"Okay."
The man sitting at the little plywood table that folded up from the wall onto a hinged leg finished writing on the pad of paper and took off the headset and laid it on the table in front of him and passed both hands backwards over the sides of his black hair. He turned and looked toward the rear of the trailer where the second man was stretched out on the bed.
"Listo,"
he said. The man sat up and swung his legs to the floor. He sat there for a minute, and then he rose and came forward.
"You got it?"
"I got it."
He tore the sheet off the pad and handed it to him, and he read it and folded it and put it into his shirt pocket. Then he reached up and opened one of the kitchen cabinets and took out a camouflage-finished submachine gun and a pair of spare clips and pushed open the door and stepped down into the lot and shut the door behind him. He crossed the gravel to where a black Plymouth Barracuda was parked and opened the door and pitched the machine gun in on the far seat and lowered himself in and shut the door and started the engine. He blipped the throttle a couple of times and then pulled out onto the blacktop and turned on the lights and shifted into second gear and went up the road with the car squatting on the big rear tires and fishtailing and the tires whining and unspooling clouds of rubber smoke behind him. Part 8.
"I've lost a lot of friends over these last few years, not all of them older than me, neither. One of the things you realize about getting older is that not everybody is going to get older with you. You try to help the people that are paying your salary, and of course you can't help but think about the kind of record you leave. This county has not had an unsolved homicide in 41 years. Now we got 9 of them in 1 week. Will they be solved? I don't know. Every day is against you. Time is not on your side. I don't know as it'd be any compliment if you was known for second-guessing a bunch of dope dealers. Not that they have all that much trouble second-guessing us. They don't have no respect for the law. That ain't half of it. They don't even think about the law. It don't seem to even concern them. Of course, here a while back, they shot and killed a federal judge. I guess he concerned them. Add to that there's peace officers along this border getting rich off of narcotics. Now, that's a painful thing to know, or it is for me. I don't believe that was true even 10 years ago. A crooked peace officer is just a damned abomination. That's all you can say about it. He's 10 times worse than the criminal, and this ain't going away. And that's about the only thing I do know. It ain't going away. Where would it go to? And this may sound ignorant, but I think for me the worst of it is knowing that probably the only reason I'm even still alive is that they have no respect for me. And that's very painful. Very painful. It has done got way beyond anything you might have thought about even a few years ago. Here a while back, they found a DC-4 over in Presidio County, just setting out in the desert. They'd come in there of a night and graded out a sort of landing strip and set out rows of tar barrels for lights, but there was no way you could have flown that thing back out of there. It was stripped out to the walls, just had a pilot seat in it. You could smell the marijuana, you didn't need no dog. Well, the sheriff over there, and I won't say his name, he wanted to get set up and nail them when they come back for the plane. And finally, somebody told him that they wasn't nobody coming back. Never had been. When he finally understood what it was they was telling him, he just got real quiet. And then he turned around and got in his car and left. When they was having them dope wars down across the border, you could not buy a half-quart mason jar nowheres to put up your preserves and such, your chow-chow. There wasn't none to be had. What it was, they was using them jars to put hand grenades in. If you flew over somebody's house or compound and you dropped grenades on them, they'd go off before they hit the ground. So what they'd done was, they'd pull the pin and stick them down in the jar and screw the lid back on. Then, whenever they hit the ground, the glass would break and release the spoon, the lever. They would preload cases of them things. Hard to believe that a man would ride around at night in a small plane with a cargo such as that, but they done it. I think if you were Satan and you were sitting around trying to think up something that would just bring the human race to its knees, what you'd probably come up with is narcotics. Maybe he did. I told that to somebody at breakfast the other morning, and they asked me if I believed in Satan. I said, well, that ain't the point. And they said, I know, but do you? I had to think about that. I guess as a boy I did. Come the middle years, my belief, I reckon, had waned somewhat. Now I'm starting to lean back the other way. He explains a lot of things that otherwise don't have no explanation. Or not to me, they don't.
Ma set the case in the booth and eased himself in after it. He lifted the menu from the wire rack where it stood along with the mustard and ketchup. She scooted into the booth opposite. He didn't look up.
What are you having? He said.
I don't know. I ain't looked at the menu.
He spun the menu around and slid it in front of her and turned and looked for the waitress.
What are you? The girl said.
What am I having?
No. What are you? Are you a character?
He studied her.
The only people I know that know what a character is, he said,
is other characters.
I might just be a fellow traveler.
Fellow traveler?
Yeah.
Well, you are now.
You're hurt, ain't you?
What makes you say that?
You can't hardly walk.
Maybe it's just an old war injury.
I don't think so. What happened to you?
You mean lately?
Yeah, lately.
You don't need to know.
Why not?
I don't want you getting all excited on me.
What makes you think I'd get excited?
'Cause bad girls like bad boys. What are you going to have?
I don't know. What is it you do?
3 weeks ago, I was a law-abiding citizen, working a 9-to-5 job, 8-to-4 anyways. Things happen to you, they happen. They don't ask first. They don't require your permission.
That's the truth if ever I heard it told, she said.
You hang around me, you'll hear some more of it.
You think I'm a bad girl?
I think you'd like to be.
What's in that briefcase?
Briefs.
What's in it?
I could tell you, but then I'd have to kill you.
You ain't supposed to carry a gun in a public place. Did you not know that? In particular, a gun such as that.
Let me ask you something.
Go ahead.
When the shooting starts, would you rather be armed or be legal?
No, I don't want to be around no shooting.
Yes, you do. It's rode all over you. You just don't want to get shot. What are you having?
What are you?
Cheeseburger and chocolate milk. The waitress came and they ordered. She got the hot beef sandwich with mashed potatoes and gravy.
You ain't even asked me where I was going, she said.
I know where you're going.
Where am I going, then?
Down the road.
That ain't no answer.
It's more than just an answer.
You don't know everything.
No, I don't.
You ever kill anybody?
Yeah, he said. You? She looked embarrassed.
You know I ain't never killed nobody.
I don't know that.
Well, I ain't.
You ain't, then.
You ain't done either. Are you?
Done what?
What I just said.
Killing people? She looked around to see if they might be overheard.
Yes,
she said. Be hard to say. After a while, the waitress brought their plates. He bit the corner off a packet of mayonnaise and squeezed out the contents over his cheeseburger and reached for the ketchup. Where are you from? He said. She took a drink of her iced tea and wiped her mouth with a paper napkin.
Port Arthur, she said.
He nodded. He took up the cheeseburger in both hands and bit into it and sat back, chewing. I ain't never been to Port Arthur, he said.
I ain't never seen you there.
How could you have seen me there if I ain't never been there?
I couldn't. I was just saying I ain't. I was agreeing with you.
Moss shook his head. They ate. I reckon you're on your way to California.
How did you know that?
That's the direction you're headed in.
Well, that's where I'm going.
You got any money?
What's it to you?
It ain't nothing to me, do you?
I got some.
He finished the cheeseburger and wiped his hands on the paper napkin and drank the rest of the milk. Then he reached in his pocket and took out the roll of hundreds and unfolded them. He counted out $1,000 onto the formica and pushed it toward her and put the roll back in his pocket. Let's go, he said.
What's that for?
To go to California on.
What do I got to do for it?
You don't have to do nothing. Even a blind sow finds an acorn every once in a while. Put that up and let's go. They paid and walked out to the truck.
You wasn't calling me a sow back yonder, was you?
Moss ignored her. Give me the keys, he said. She took the keys from her pocket and handed them over.
I thought maybe you forgot I had them, she said.
I don't forget much.
I could have just slipped off like I was going to the ladies' room and took your truck and left you sitting there.
No, you couldn't have.
Why not?
Get in the truck. They got in, and he set the case between them and pulled the Tech 9 out of his belt and slid it under the seat.
Why not? She said.
Don't be ignorant all your life. In the first place, I could see all the way to the front door and out the parking lot clear to the truck. In the second place, even if I was dumbass enough to sit with my back to the door, I'd have just called a cab and run you down and pulled you over and beat the shit out of you and left you laying there. She got real quiet. He put the key in the ignition and started the truck and backed it out.
Would you have done that?
What do you think?
When they pulled into Van Horn, it was 7 o'clock at night. She'd slept a good part of the way, curled up with her knapsack for a pillow. He pulled into a truck stop and shut off the engine, and her eyes snapped open like a deer's. She sat up and looked at him, and then looked out at the parking lot.
Where are we?
She said.
Van Horn. You hungry?
I could eat a bite.
You want some diesel fried chicken?
What?
He pointed to the sign overhead.
I ain't eating nothing like that, she said.
She was in the ladies' room a long time. When she came out, she wanted to know if he'd ordered.
I did. I ordered some of that chicken for you.
You ain't done it, she said.
They ordered steaks.
Do you live like this all the time? She said.
Sure. When you're a big-time desperado, the sky's the limit.
What's that on that chain?
This?
Yeah.
It's a tush off a wild boar.
What do you wear that for?
It ain't mine. I'm just keeping it for somebody.
A lady somebody?
No, a dead somebody.
The steaks came. He watched her eat.
Does they anybody know where you're at? He said.
What?
I said, does anybody know where you're at?
Like who?
Like anybody.
You?
I don't know where you're at because I don't know who you are.
Well, that makes two of us.
You don't know who you are?
No, silly. I don't know who you are.
Well, we'll just keep it that way, and they won't neither of us be out nothing, all right?
All right. What'd you ask me that for?
Moss mopped up steak gravy with a half a roll.
I just thought it was probably true. For you, it's a luxury. For me, it's a necessity.
Why, because they somebody after you?
Maybe.
I do like it that way, she said. You got that part right.
It don't take long to get a taste for it, does it?
No, she said. It don't.
Well, it ain't as simple as it sounds, you'll see.
Why's that?
There's always somebody knows where you're at, knows where and why, for the most part.
Are you talking about God?
No, I'm talking about you. She ate.
Well, she said, you'd be in a fix if you didn't know where you was at.
I don't know. Would you?
No, I don't know.
Suppose you was someplace that you didn't know where it was. The real thing you wouldn't know was where someplace else was, or how far it was. It wouldn't change nothing about where you was at. She thought about that.
I try not to think about stuff like that, she said.
You think when you get to California, you'll kind of start over.
Them's my intentions.
I think maybe that's the point. There's a road going to California, and there's one coming back. But the best way would be just to show up there.
Show up there?
Yeah.
You mean, and not know how you got there?
Yeah, and not know how you got there.
I don't know how you do that.
I don't either. That's the point.
She ate. She looked around.
Can I get some coffee?
She said.
You can get anything you want. You got money.
She looked at him.
I guess I ain't sure what the point is, she said.
The point is there ain't no point.
No, I mean what you said about knowing where you are.
He looked at her. After a while, he said,
"It's not about knowing where you are.
It's about thinking you got there without taking anything with you. Your notions about starting over, or anybody's, you don't start over. That's what it's about. Every step you take is forever. You can't make it go away. None of it. You understand what I'm saying?
I think so.
I know you don't, but let me try it one more time. You think when you wake up in the morning, yesterday don't count, but yesterday is all that does count. What else is there? Your life is made out of the days it's made out of, nothing else. You might think you could run away and change your name and I don't know what all, start over. And then one morning you wake up and look at the ceiling, and guess who's laying there? She nodded. You understand what I'm saying?
I understand that. I've been there.
Yeah, I know you have.
So, are you sorry you become an outlaw?
Sorry I didn't start sooner. Are you ready? When he came out of the motel office, he handed her a key.
What's that?
That's your key. She hefted it in her hand and looked at him.
Well, she said, it's up to you.
Yes, it is.
I guess you're afraid I'll see what's in that bag.
Not really. He started the truck and pulled down the parking lot behind the motel office.
Are you queer?
She said. Me? Yeah, I'm queer as a coot.
You don't look it.
Is that right? You know a lot of queers?
You don't act it, I guess I should say.
Well, darling, what would you know about it?
I don't know.
Say it again.
What?
Say it again. I don't know.
I don't know.
That's good. You need to practice that. It sounds good on you.